Hello, everybody. Hi there, my It's All About Food listeners. I'm so happy to be here with you today. It has been quite a week, hasn't it? Did you get through Thanksgiving? We did, and it was super, super yummy. We baked up a lot of food. I think we talked about some of the food we were going to make for Thanksgiving last week. We did it all. There's typically one fail, though. Something always doesn't go right, right? And here's what didn't go right. I was so disappointed. Gary made an incredible polenta stuffing that we were going to put inside a blue winter squash, and I bought one a week before, and it was a beautiful, beautiful shaped squash and so ripe for stuffing. And then when we went to prepare it, the bottom was moldy. I can't believe it. I have bought so many squashes in my day that have lasted for my favorite subject, food, like I was just doing. Anyway, we had a great Thanksgiving. Some of the recipes that we made are at responsibleeatingandliving.com. I'll get back to that later. Right now, I want to bring on my guest because we're going to be talking about yummy food. And this time, it's food from the South, from Mississippi. I've got the Mississippi vegan on today. Timothy Parkin is a passionate cook, artist, and photographer, and the creator of the blog Mississippi Vegan. Before devoting himself to the culinary arts, he spent time as a fine artist in Charleston, South Carolina, and New York City, and he currently lives and works in New Orleans. Timothy, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, I've been devouring your book.
Oh, you have? Good.
Yes. I read it all. The stories are wonderful. I wanted to say I loved Issa Chandra Mosquist's foreword. You must have loved it too. It was really lovely.
Yeah, she's such a talented writer, and she's really funny. And I mean, before I read the book, I wanted her to write the foreword. And so when she said that she would, I was really excited. And, you know, that was the last thing that was put in the book, and I felt like it really kind of tied everything in together. So I'm really, really happy with the foreword.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. You take beautiful photos, and the recipes, I can tell, are quite yummy.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So before we get started, I'm just curious. You lived in New York City for a while, and I understand you worked at a few vegan restaurants in New York City?
I served at a few different. Funny enough, when I started doing Mississippi, I was still working as a server, and this restaurant actually changed ownership, and I actually created the menu for it. It was really funny how that happened. But then I started doing pop-up events at different event spaces. So that's when I was working in the kitchen and serving.
Okay, so now it's your turn to break up, and I'm not quite sure why you're breaking up, but if there's anything you can do on your end, that would be nice.
Okay. So
I hear you, and then I don't hear you.
I'm trying to stay in one spot. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Okay, great. Okay. So let's move to the book. And I kind of made a list of some of the recipes I wanted to talk about that popped out to me. And the first one I want to talk about is your Mirliton corn bisque.
Yes.
And I've never used the Mirliton. I think I've seen them in Costa Rica. You've called them also chayotes.
Mm-hmm. They have a lot of different names, but in this region, they call them Mirlitons. But they have, like, if you look at their Wikipedia page, they have like 20 different names.
Yeah, I've seen them and I've never known what to do with them. So now I have a recipe, the corn bisque. And
yeah,
I'm wondering,
honestly, when
I make a corn bisque, I usually use a potato. Is this anything like a potato, or is it? What's it like?
It's like if a zucchini and a potato had a baby. So it's kind of firm, like the texture of like a, but it's a little bit more succulent and it's a little bit more juicy. And it's funny because when I made that recipe, I boiled the chunks in it with the broth, and then I was going to puree everything and eat it as like a solely pureed bisque. But the chunks were so tender and succulent, I decided to leave them, like to leave the chunks in. Could
very
do whatever,
good.
But I think once you bring it to a boil, they're really delicious. So, but I would compare it to like a zucchini.
I love it. If a potato and a zucchini had a baby, I may steal that
exactly.
from you.
Yeah, steal it. You can have it.
Okay, thank you. Speaking of blending part of the soup or the stew or whatever, I want to bring up your slow-cooked red and beans rice.
Mm.
And you, after you cook it for a very long time, you blend some of it, right?
Well, what I noticed with that recipe is when I was making the recipe, because, you know, I grew up eating all this food, but it was not vegan. It was, you know, just the traditional recipe. But I remember when I made it and I called my mom and I was like, I don't know what I'm missing because it doesn't have that creamy kind of thick gravy texture. And I then realized, I researched a lot of different recipes, and yeah, the trick is to blending up some with oil, and it kind of like emulsifies and becomes like a whipped bean mixture, and then you reincorporate it, and that's what kind of gives it that kind of creamy texture. So I definitely advise not to skip that step. It's really important, and I definitely, that was kind of the missing link for me with that recipe.
Yeah, well, thanks for that secret. I love the concept because I can be confused when I'm making the soup. Do I want it to be chunky? Do I want it to be creamy? And sometimes it's nice to have both.
Yeah, totally. I think, especially with the Mirliton bisque and the red beans and rice, I think you get that like kind of velvety, luxurious texture, but then you also get some of the chunks, which is just a nice variation. So, you know, I definitely agree with you. I like to have both just for a variety of textures. I think with all my recipes, I think the more variety of texture, the more kind of pleasing the overall dish is.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of my listeners know that I go nuts over lion's mane mushroom. I have one of my favorite restaurants in California recently started putting a dish on their menu with lion's mane, and I just go nuts over it, like I said. And you have a great lion's mane mushroom mornay in your book. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, so it's so funny. When I first had lion's mane in New York, a farmer at the farmer's market was cultivating it, because you can grow it indoors. I had some, and I went home and I sauteed it in a cast iron skillet with a little bit of oil and salt and pepper. And I was just so amazed at how it had the same texture of crab meat. It just really, it's kind of like that delicately fibrous texture that crab meat has, kind of tender and kind of breaks apart. And
yeah,
when I was working on the recipes, I was thinking, what's the best way to, you know, utilize this crab meat? And my mom always made crab mornay for a Christmas party. And it was always the first thing, $100 worth of crab meat and a ton of butter and cheese and cream. And so, so I just replaced it. And the funny thing is you can use any mushroom for that sauce. It's going to be good. But if you can get lion's mane, I think there's one person that cultivates it here in New Orleans. But if you can get it, it really hits that texture, and it really satisfies that craving for crab meat in the recipe.
And a lot of the high-end mushrooms are expensive, but they can't be as expensive as crab meat. And there's no bad cost to the environment.
Totally. And what's funny about that lion's mane is I actually foraged that on the Natchez Trace Parkway. And
wow.
This is actually the season for them right now. They like it when it gets a little bit cooler. And the one thing, you know, I'm not going to advise anyone to forage wild mushrooms unless they know a lot about it. But one of the great identification factors of lion's mane is there's really no other mushroom that looks like it. So I'm not saying to necessarily consume it, but if you're just trying to ID the mushroom, lion's mane is a pretty easy one to identify because it has such a unique structure.
Yeah, it's hairy, like a mane.
It is.
Yeah, it's a really funny looking mushroom. Okay, the next thing I wanted to talk about was blueberry barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
How crazy is that?
You know, it's so funny because, I mean, when I worked at a restaurant, they did a strawberry barbecue sauce. And I remember just loving it because it had that tang. And I thought blueberries would just make such a fun sauce. And if you notice in the picture, if you get the sunlight to hit it, the barbecue sauce, it has this like beautiful, like purple magenta color. So it's really fun.
Well, I'm all about food that's good for you. And blueberries are like one of the top superfoods. So anything you can put them in is a win.
Yeah, totally. I think, I agree. The color of them kind of just tells you how nutrient dense, you know, they are. So I agree. I think sneaking them into anything, even a barbecue sauce, is a win in my book.
Okay. Now this book is featuring recipes from Mississippi, some of the recipes, but we have this Southern flair to it. And I want you to take a moment and tell us about gumbo.
Okay. So gumbo was the first like recipe that I learned to make, and my mom taught me how to make it. So my mom and dad both were born and raised in New Orleans, and my mom learned to make gumbo when she was young, and that was the first recipe that I asked her to teach me. And I remember the most important things about gumbo was really taking your time making the roux and browning the flour with oil and getting it nice and toasty. And what I remember the most is when she would add the trinity, so the celery, the green bell pepper, the onions, and then eventually the garlic. And when all that hit the hot roux, the whole house just smelled so amazing. Mm. And so in my mind, that was always what I remember gumbo to be. And that ends up, you know, being the plant-based ingredients. And my other favorite thing about gumbo was that you used okra. And I've always loved okra. It's probably my favorite vegetable. So when I went vegan, it just made so much sense for me to make gumbo and just to make it how I learned to make it and just not at the end add the sausage or the chicken. And then eventually I learned that you can add, you know, large chunks of mushrooms, or you can add hearty chunks of vegetable, or you can add even a vegan sausage. And I like to add greens to mine, like kale, like shredded kale. And what I learned when I was writing the book is that the word gumbo actually means okra. And so it's been funny to hear people get confused when I say vegan gumbo. But in actuality, the reason gumbo is so special is because of the plants that we're using to make it. So it's the paprika and the cayenne pepper and the bay leaves and the onions and the bell pepper and the garlic and the flour. Those are what's making gumbo that authentic traditional recipe. And sure, people, you do add shrimp and sausage, which does affect the flavor. But that's, in my opinion, that's a small percentage of what gumbo is.
Okay, now I'm someone who has never acquired a taste for okra. I know it's very nutritious, and I really want to grow up and learn to like it. Do you have any tips? Should I just make a gumbo and just see what happens?
What I would say, the first thing you should do is try my skillet okra, because what I think people do, the mistake people make is they overcook it, and then it becomes even more slimy than it already is. Mm-hmm. So what I recommend is cooking it with really high heat and with the salt, pepper, and a splash of vinegar, just a little bit of acid to kind of give it some tang, and get it nice and crispy on the outside, but you still want it to have a hearty texture. You still want to be able to bite into it. And that's what I recommend. And if you don't like it that way, then we can just accept that you don't like okra, and it's okay.
I always like to tell people, if they say they don't like a certain food, like they don't like broccoli, it's like, okay, there are so many different foods to eat in the plant kingdom. You don't have to like all of them.
You don't have to like all of them. I mean, me personally, like, I don't like sea vegetables. They just taste too much like fish to me. So that's one, like, plant food that I don't love. But I would say in the gumbo, you could absolutely put large chunks of merlaton. That would be a beautiful vegetable to put in the gumbo. And you can also put, I know it's hard to find, but purslane. I don't know if you've ever had purslane, but it has.
I don't like purslane. It's another slimy vegetable.
Yeah. You know what I would say? I would say just avoid the slimies and use merlaton. And you know what is great in gumbo too is like, I heard you talking about that winter squash, but like large chunks of kabocha squash or butternut.
Oh, that's good.
Or honey nuts. Good in the gumbo. Yeah.
So good. Just look at the bottom and make sure it's not moldy first.
I know. You know, when you said that, I'm laughing because I have three huge ones and their decorations outside on my front porch and they're like in perfect condition.
They last forever, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was okay. We had too much food to begin with, and it all worked out. I wanted to thank you because when I was reading your first gumbo recipe and I realized that it had white flour in it or wheat flour in it, and I'm personally avoiding gluten and wheat for the most part, and I was thinking in my head as I'm looking at the recipe, okay, I wonder if what other flour I might use to thicken it. And then you answered my question in the next recipe, which was great. And I'm glad you did all the work.
Yeah, sorghum flour works great. You know, I've used chickpea flour, and it worked, but the chickpea flour kind of separates a little bit, and it's fine, but it doesn't have quite as smooth a texture as if you use sorghum flour. So I highly recommend sorghum flour for a gluten-free room.
Yeah, good. I love sorghum flour for many different things. It has a flavor somewhat similar to wheat, and it has a nice mellow sweetness. And that's the plant kingdom. If you can't eat one, there are so many others that can fill in the space.
Yes. No, it's very true. And you know, at the end of the day, we're just trying to recreate a texture and a flavor. So if we can do that with other ingredients that are easier for certain people to digest, then we should absolutely do that.
Okay. Last thing I wanted to talk about gumbo is the wooden spatula. Uh-huh. And I'm so glad you talked about the wooden spatula because I know a lot of people, they're frustrated with cooking and they don't have the time, they don't have the skills, and they don't have the tools. And wooden utensils, like a wooden spoon or a wooden spatula with a long handle is so essential.
Oh, totally. I mean, I don't know how any other way to make, I mean, you could try using a whisk, but you're probably going to burn the roux, and it's going to make it a really frustrating recipe to make. So I have quite a few wooden spatulas that are curved. I have probably like four or five. It's so funny you say that because I actually chipped off one today, and I was so upset because it was my favorite one. And so I'm on the hunt for another one because the shape of it is so perfect. It's like just long enough. And it has a really nice long edge, and I'm just so upset. But you know what? At the end of the day, it's wood. It's like it can't last forever. But a good worn down roux spoon, like wooden spatula, is I agree with you, is a essential kitchen tool.
Well, in some ways, it's like seasoned after a while. I think it makes everything just taste better. My partner, Gary, is Italian, and when he makes sauce, he's got to have a wooden spoon to make his sauce. Otherwise, it won't be good.
Yeah, no, it's those little things in cooking, the little traditions, you know, the little, things that happen over and over again that, it's kind of part of the experience, and that's really what a good recipe is. It's just, you know, it's a tradition, and it's human.
Okay, Timothy, did I just lose you? Because I don't hear you anymore. I hope you're still there. I wanted to mention another recipe or a couple of recipes, and that were the bacon recipes. The potato bacon and the mushroom rice paper bacon. Oh, my goodness.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I'm talking about your bacon recipes now, the potato bacon and the mushroom rice paper bacon.
Yeah, there's quite a few bacon recipes in the book.
Yeah, they're good. You know, I was going to thumb through the Baconish cookbook. I don't know if you've seen it, but I don't think she had these kind of recipes in her book. And as like as you mentioned in the book, we vegans like to make bacon out of everything.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think what's important, can you hear me? Are we good?
Yes, we're good.
What I would say, what's important, I think people are always perplexed, like, well, if you're vegan, why are you trying to make, why don't you just eat bacon if you want bacon? And what people need to understand is what we're craving is the experience of eating bacon. We want the texture. We want the flavor. We want something that's smoky and salty and crispy and chewy and fatty. You know, in actuality, we're not craving the pig that's alive and like living in a field somewhere. What we're craving is the end result. So I didn't go vegan because bacon was delicious. You know, I went vegan because I don't want to kill the pig. So if I can eat bacon that is made from plants or mushrooms, then I absolutely will because it's delicious.
Exactly. And that's where we're going, I think, in the 21st century, making everyone's favorite foods with plants instead of with animals. I know that when I've been in hotels that serve breakfast and they have the hot chafe covered chafing dishes and I know what's inside them, there's sausage and bacon, I can hear the screams of the pigs when I pass by. Now, I don't know where they come from, if it's all in my own subconscious or if, you know, I'm connecting to some other dimension, but I don't want to eat pig bacon because to me it looks and smells like torture, pain, suffering, and death.
Well, that's, you know, and not to turn it into such a dark conversation, but people ask me how I do it, and it's like I'm not tempted by these foods because when I see them, that's what I see. I see straight through it. And so I think what people need to do moving forward is they need to stop asking, you know, why vegans are trying to recreate things that aren't vegan and celebrate that we can recreate things and make them vegan and healthier. And we can remove the animal from it and still achieve that texture and flavor. And so when we switch it and we kind of celebrate and we just appreciate it for what it is, delicious food, then the conversation doesn't have to be like, why are you trying to do that? Like, well, you know, it doesn't have to be that. It can just be positive, you know? I think people ask me all the time, they're like, they just, you know, they ask me, you know, why I'm vegan, or they kind of want to just get in an argument with me. And I always say that my veganism is a celebration of what I do eat. You know, instead of me focusing on what I don't eat, I've already decided that I'm not going to eat animal or animal products. I'm so busy focusing on what I do eat that I wrote a whole cookbook about it, and I have a whole Instagram that's dedicated to it. And, you know, I'm just full-time eating delicious food. And that's really what veganism is to me. It's full-time eating delicious plant mushroom-based food.
I'm right there with you. And I don't like to talk much about the dark side. The dark side is out there, but I prefer to point people in the direction of the light, which is this yummy, delicious food. So I'm right there with you. It's interesting that you call yourself the Mississippi vegan. I know you're originally from Mississippi. And Mississippi, unfortunately, is one of the unhealthiest states. They could certainly use learning a little bit about how to make some traditional recipes vegan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what happened is Mississippi just went, and just like a lot of southern states, and just were a lot of unhealthy people, the food systems went in a wrong direction really quickly. And, you know, I think a lot of the unhealthy foods are coming from processed, you know, food companies, and it's like, you know, factory farm animals. That's not what I think about Mississippi. I think Mississippi, like having a backyard garden and, you know, lady peas and okra and tomatoes. And so I think, yeah, Mississippi too, it needs a positive light shed on it, which is what I wanted to do. I felt like it was my duty to kind of show people that there are artistic, creative people that are vegan that are from Mississippi. And I think exploring the undercurrent of veganism and kind of making it relatable so that people in Mississippi, like, it doesn't need to be weird. Like, I'm still eating all the food I grew up eating. You know, I'm still celebrating all the food. But we need to focus on the healthier ingredient, and we need to make that be the foundation of our food system. And that's going to help everyone be healthy, and it's going to help the environment.
The last thing I wanted to talk about is the fact that I read your book, and I know that you're an artist, and you love preparing wonderful, beautiful food. It's a joy. It's a celebration. I understand. I love to cook. And there are so many people that don't. And maybe some of them want to. Maybe some of them watch food shows. Maybe some of them are listening to this show. I know I've heard from some of you who say you'd like to, but you don't. I always say find your kitchen. And people don't have the skills. They don't have the traditional recipes from their family. And how do we get them there? I mean, as an artist, you are living your life. And I like to say that convenience is like not living when you go for convenience. How much of your life do you want to miss? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we should be learning and experiencing and getting in the kitchen and cooking and being around people. But some people don't agree with me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I would say is I would invite everyone to go to a farmer's market and to just try to buy something there. Buy something that interests you or that you're familiar with and support a local farmer and bring it home into the kitchen. And then whatever you get, say it's a butternut squash or, you know, half a pound of okra or whatever, and then just Google, you know, a recipe or look in my book and see where it has it. And make a simple, easy recipe. I mean, you could go to the vegetable sides of my book. They're all super simple. And it's literally just as simple as roasting a vegetable with salt and pepper, maybe a little bit of vinegar, and maybe a dried herb. It just start there, and then once you make one thing that you like and that's delicious, I think it gives people that confidence, and then they want to make something else. So I think we need to instill this confidence. So by starting small, yes, and making something delicious, then it'll make people want to cook more. But at the end of the day, people have to care, you know? You have to care. If you don't care what you're eating and you don't care about making delicious food, then it's not going to be for you, you know?
Yes. Yes. Anyway, back to Mississippi Vegan. This is a lovely cookbook. You've done a fine job. The recipes are all page lickable. And I'm excited to have it, and I'm going to learn how to eat okra.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that, and that means a lot to me. And I wanted the book to be touching. And I feel like it's been touching to a lot of people, so that makes me really happy.
Yeah, the holidays are coming. This is a great gift for the holidays, or has a lot of recipes that I think would work well for your holiday table.
Yeah, it's definitely a holiday cookbook. And if any of your listeners need kind of proof of the pudding, they can look at my Instagram. It's at Mississippi Vegan, and they can see there's a whole bunch of free content for them, and maybe they can understand where I'm coming from when they see my photography.
Excellent. Timothy, thank you so much for spending some time with me today and for writing Mississippi Vegan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Well, I meant every word. I meant every bite. And I really can't wait to dip into some of these recipes. And if you're following my blog, What Vegans Eat, I will mention what recipes that I've made that come from this book, and then you can see them there as well. That's at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and the blog is called What Vegans Eat. Hey, how's everybody doing today? I want to thank the people that wrote to me, because I've been asking for some of your feedback about this show. It's all about food. And I still haven't heard from enough people. I got some wonderful messages, but you know what? I want more. I really want to know what people are thinking and what they like and what they don't like. Now, one of the fun things that I got from, I think, everybody who wrote me is that they really enjoy when my partner Gary joins me on the show. So guess what? Surprise! I'm bringing him on again today. Gary DeMattei, how are you?
Hi, Karen. Wow, what a great show that was.
Were you listening?
Yeah, Timothy's great. His book is phenomenal. I am a witness. I've seen the book. I've read the book with you. And Timothy, you're doing great work. Thanks so much. And you know what he was just saying? Hi, everybody. It's great to be back. I hope you all had a happy Thanksgiving. Did you have a happy Thanksgiving, everybody?
Good. Everybody, I did. Yeah, it was the next day that was a little crazy, but maybe we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we should talk about that later. So, but what you and Timothy were talking about is really something I wanted to touch on too. And there's really no greater example of the creative process than cooking, don't you think?
And yes,
that's why I think so many artists make great cooks as well. And, passionate cooks. And Timothy sounds like he's a very passionate guy, a very passionate cook. And I love what he said about just go to a farmer's market and pick up a squash and put it in the oven and throw some herbs on it and see what happens. And because there's really no talent in eating. I mean, we all,
no talent in eating.
No, or that's buying funny. Buying pre-made food or going to a restaurant.
Oh, I see. Yes, it's easy to eat. We all eat, but it does take the little effort to prepare food.
It doesn't require any major talent to eat something that's already prepared for you, right? But there are so many people who have so much talent that they don't even know. And a great place to start is in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And see your talent, no pun intended, unearthed when you start to cook vegetables and see how many different varieties of vegetables there are. And for example, the apple, that's not a vegetable, but, and it's not a good segue, but how many people.
But you want to talk about apples.
Well, how many people bought an apple pie already made? And now where's the fun in that? And you know, I think that making an apple pie has been made difficult by so many people, but did you know that the first apple pie did not? Well, first of all, it's not an American thing. You know how everybody says it's as American as apple pie? It's not American. I mean, the apple that we use today for apple pie was brought over from Asia. And thousands of years ago, the apple was discovered in Asia. And then brought over by the folks that came over and colonized this place that's now called America. But the only indigenous apple here in what we now call America was the crab apple, and that's kind of inferior to pie making. And but the original apple pie didn't have sugar. Did you know that?
I didn't know any of this, Gary. This is all fascinating to me. Did anybody else know this?
So how simple is that? You cut up an apple and you bake it in the oven. And also the original crust wasn't edible. It was a shell that you weren't supposed to eat. And did you know that?
I remember reading something like that for meat, that some crusts were made to hold meat inside.
Right.
Yeah. But how wasteful is that? Why not make it so it's edible? So that's a good thing.
Some genius decided, well, let's eat the whole thing, the dish and the pie in the middle. But the reason I'm talking about apple pie is because you've just put up an incredible recipe that I would say is as simple as pie for anyone to make, because it doesn't require any sugar. It just requires a really good apple, right?
Yeah.
And the crust is as simple as blending a fat with a flour.
Yeah, can I talk about this?
Yeah,
thanks for bringing that up.
This is, and you could also tell us what the name of it is.
I will.
Because you speak French. And
So go ahead.
Take it away.
I did live in France for 4 years in the early 90s. But before I did, I had learned how to make a pie crust. And I could make an American apple pie, even though it's not really originating from the United States. And then I went to France, and when I would go to some family barbecues, some friends having picnics and whatever at their home, there would be someone would always put together a really fast tart au pomme, which is an apple pie. It's only one crust, and they would just like put sliced apples in it, and it was done, and they'd bake it. And then I started making my own. I've looked online to see how they're made traditionally. Some people might put a little applesauce in the bottom and then the apples on top. But I just slice the apples as thin as I can. I like using one of those round apple slicer things.
Right, those are fun.
An apple slicer. I didn't even know they existed, and then I saw one at a friend's house. But they make it a lot easier. You just slam it on the apple, and it removes the core and slices it into six pieces. And then you can make them even thinner.
Right.
And you have a choice of how you might want to lay them out. If you go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and see my tarte au pomme recipe, you can see how I laid it out. It kind of looks like a giant flower, maybe.
Right. It looks great. It's a beautiful picture. And
but there's no sugar.
It's right on the homepage. There's no sugar.
More thing I wanted to say.
Yeah.
I started making this gluten-free pie crust because, as I mentioned before, I'm avoiding wheat. And I never had a problem making a pie crust, but I know some people do. You have to chop the fat into cold bits and then knead it with the dough and then add a little bit of water. And it has to be, like, just right. And then you roll it out. But this gluten-free pie crust is easier.
Right.
I do it all in a food processor. I throw everything into the food processor. The dough comes out, and I put it between two pieces of parchment paper. It's very forgiving. So you can roll it, and if something's breaking or whatever, you just peel it and stick it somewhere else. It's a very friendly, easy-to-roll dough, and it's gluten-free. And I have a recipe that uses confectioner's sugar, but this time I didn't want to use any refined sugar, so I made one without. And the only thing I want to say is when you're making a sweet crust with gluten-free flour, I recommend a gluten-free flour that isn't made with beans. Like we use Bob's Red Mill all-purpose gluten-free flour, and it has a base of garbanzo bean flour in it, which is great. But it has a beany taste, and you can add other seasonings and things to mask it. But when you're making it sweet, the confectioner sugar does a pretty good job of masking that beany flavor. But Bob's Red Mill also has a 1-to-1 all-purpose gluten-free flour, and that's not bean-based. And I find that that's better for sweet pastries, but they're both fine. But they're just easy. That's the point. They're easy.
So there's a gluten-free flour, Bob's Red Mill, and there's a 1-to-1. But they're both gluten-free.
Yes, correct.
I gotcha. And then for a while, you were making your own mix, and people can do that. A lot of people I know that are already well into gluten-free baking make their own mix. But the Bob's Red Mill is a great place to start, and they do have a nice variety of grains and ground gluten-free flours and things like that. And we like them here at Responsible Eating and Living, right?
Yes, we do.
And I liked what you said, Timothy Packron, Mrs. B. Vegan's cookbook was page lickable. That was good. That was good. And I would say this tarte au pomme. How do you pronounce it again?
Tarte au pomme. I want to add that we buy organic apples. You should always buy organic apples.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah.
You don't have to peel them. Tarte au pomme, all my apple pies, I never peel the apples. The apples are nutritious, and as soon as you cook them, they get soft. You don't even know they're there.
Yeah, exactly. And that was my next point, is that you don't need sugar when you buy a really great organic apple. And I really have never had a bad organic apple. I've had many bad apples that haven't been organic, but never one that's been organic. And they're all so sweet. There's something really special. Now, again, it could be the placebo effect, which we've talked about before on the show, but I don't think so. I really, I really don't. So I encourage everyone out there to buy organic. And occasionally when you can't buy organic, make sure it's locally grown. Like Timothy said, go to a farmer's market, buy from a local grower. And this holiday season, buy locally, buy your holiday gifts locally as well. Find a small boutique somewhere run by someone that wants to, that has the entrepreneurial spirit, and or go to one of these trade shows. We have friends who go to these shows and sell their wares. Go buy art that's been painted by a local artist that's sitting there along the boardwalk or somewhere where they're painting. And I mean, some of the work is really amazing. And try not to shop at big, huge corporations.
Yeah, we talked about this before, but I want to remind everyone that we are citizens in a community, and we are not consumers, although our government and corporations are considering us as consumers. We really need to think of ourselves as part of a community, citizens of community. And if you want to buy a gift for someone, it shouldn't just be because you have to and you just get anything to be a consumer.
Right. We really should be, you know, and I don't want to get preachy because
we're preaching.
Which is all about food. But the reason it sounds a bit preachy might be because my next comment is about being of service. And there's no greater service than going into your kitchen and cooking your family a meal. And yes, patronizing a small restaurant, buying a meal from your local diner that you know the folks, the owners of, that's also doing a nice thing as well. Barack Obama said it best, I think. The best way to not feel hopeless is to get up and do something. Don't wait for good things to happen to you. If you go out and make some good things happen, you will fill the world with hope. You will fill yourself with hope. And, you know, today is, I guess, the elephant in the room. The vegan elephant in the room is today is Giving Tuesday. And so, yes, Karen and I run this nonprofit. What is Giving Tuesday? Okay, Giving Tuesday was created by the team at the Belfer Center for Innovation and Social Impact at the 92nd Street Y, which is right here in New York City. And that's a cultural center, and it's been there since 1874. And it's been bringing people together around the values of service and giving back. So they came up with, along with someone else, and I don't really remember who that was right now, but was another organization. They came up with Giving Tuesday, which is basically the statement on their website says that it connects diverse groups of individuals, communities, and organizations around the world for one common purpose, to celebrate and encourage giving. Okay, I won't go on and read. You've obviously been Giving Tuesday to if you're on social media right now, because that's how this thing happened. It was a result of social media. So you're seeing all of you're seeing all the posts about Giving Tuesday. Well, our organization provides information to you at no charge to you that is truthful information. This is real information, which is why we call our organization Responsible Eating and Living. We give you the truth, the real truth about your food and how it gets to you and how you can protect yourself from people who are trying to poison you. Hence the discussion of organic versus non-organic. Now, trust me, I grew up in a family where if it said organic on it, they wouldn't buy it because they thought it meant something fancy schmancy and they wanted just, you know, to support just conventional produce. And but what you're missing the point if you don't see what's really happening with your food. And we're here to tell you what's happening with it. And we do a lot of research. We're a small organization. And yeah, your donations, your tax-deductible donations would help. But that's not the point. I'm not bringing it up for that reason. What I am bringing it up for is that there's a lot of organizations out there that are going to be asking for your money. Make sure you know what they do. And if your best interest is at the center or is at the spine of their mission statement, and here at Responsible Eating and Living, your best interest is at the heart of why we're doing this organization. We want you to know the truth about your food. And that connecting the dots, the truth about how your food gets to your supermarket. How much pain and suffering does your food go through before it gets to you? And when I'm just talking about the animals, which is a no-brainer, they suffer and they are sacrificed for your table. I'm also talking about vegetables and the farmers who pick them. How much suffering do they go through? And when you're picking vegetables all day for a living and those vegetables are covered in poison, that's affecting the person who is picking those vegetables.
It's also affecting their families, because if they don't have the proper protective coverings, and many of them don't, they come home and they bring it all into the house.
Right. And like we talked about last week on It's All About Food, right before Thanksgiving, there's nothing more beautiful than organic farming. That with the Three Sisters dish that we talked about, and the working in cooperation with the soil and having one plant shade the ground and another plant provide a climbing mechanism for another vine so that you don't have to go into the fields and put bean poles and do a bunch of other stuff. It's just as natural as you can possibly make it, while also having to control the environment that the plants are grown in. So, and then the bugs eat certain, and organic farming is just, it's just amazing, the whole concept. And makes so much sense. Anyway, this is Giving Tuesday. I wanted you to know a little bit about that, because whether you give to us or give to another organization, know what's at the heart of that organization. Know if they exist to be of service, which is why we exist, or if they're just there for their own self-interest, in which case, how do you find out? Well, you just have to do some research. Anyway.
Yeah, that's great. I just want to echo what you're saying. It feels good to give. It feels good to give. And this is not exactly the same thing, but I was just at a lunch yesterday with a distant cousin of mine, and he ended up treating us all to lunch, which we didn't know. And a few of the people at the table were just like fighting with him, like, no, you can't. No, you can't. No, you can't. And I finally said, some people get joy from giving. Let them have that joy.
It's true. It's very true. People, you feel good after you give. You feel better after you give than after you take. And yet so many people need you to give right now. So, but let's talk a little bit about the upcoming holidays.
Oh, yes.
Speaking
Please.
Of our website. So there's something like 21 holidays celebrated this time of year. And a lot of them are centered around religion. And there are a lot more than just two or three religions. So I'm sure that those of you who have your own holiday traditions don't need to hear about mine. But if you want ideas on how to celebrate the holidays, let's say, for example, I come from a Italian Catholic upbringing, and we have this thing called Christmas Eve, and traditionally it was a day of fasting or a night of fasting. So instead of eating, meat dishes, the tradition was to eat big feasts of fish, and that's really funny because
and that was the fast.
That was the fast. So there was the Feast of the Seven Fishes, right? Well, I did a vegan version of the Feast of the Seven Fishes, and I call it the Feast of the Seven Dishes. And you'll be able to see that soon on our slider on the homepage. But just go to Responsible Eating and Living and hit in the search bar Feast of the Seven Dishes, and you'll see a seven-course feast that we've actually made here with all kinds of amazing substitutes for all of these fish dishes that a lot of people have on Christmas Eve. Around the world.
Let me add that on our homepage, on the right-hand side, if you scroll down a little bit, there's the Real Recipe Index. And we do have a holidays section. You can click on Christmas or Hanukkah and see what we have for the winter holidays.
But I want you guys to check out both the Hanukkah dish that we have and the Feast of the Seven Dishes, because it's, you'll really get a lot of great ideas, because you're going to be having people come over and they're going to want, they're going to have different food allergies. They're going to have different, you know, restrictions. No, I can't have this. No, I can't have that. You might even get a vegan or two showing up to your house. Now, before you kick them out because you have nothing for them, check out our website. We have a lot of recipes. And same goes for Hanukkah. Karen, talk to us about your, I mean, your fabulous baked potato pancake
recipe. I can't believe it's that time of year already. Yeah. It's time for baked potato pancakes. And we put together a video a few years ago making these baked potato pancakes. We're moving more and more to more whole foods, less processed, less sugar, oil, and salt kinds of food, but we still want to make them full of flavor and delicious. And the potato pancake is traditionally grated potatoes and onions, maybe a few other things, and deep fried. Yeah, and it takes a long time. It messes up the kitchen. Everything is oily and greasy, and I'm over it. But baked potato pancakes have all of that wonderful flavor and richness of the potato and the onions. You can add a little bit of oil to it, but you don't have to deep fry it. It's so much easier to make, and I think it's a lot of fun. You can make your own homemade applesauce. You can make a vegan sour cream or something like that to serve with it. But they're easy. They're fun. And we have this great video where you can watch it. And, you know, I'm thinking, too, Gary.
Mm-hmm. I'm here.
Are you there? For Thanksgiving, I made turnip cakes.
Oh, I was just going to talk about the turnip cakes.
Oh, you were. Great minds, yeah, Gary.
They so are going to be
them. I think I mentioned it last week that I was going to try and make them, and I made them, and they're fantastic. And I'm talking
so
about it because traditionally the Chinese turnip cake, it does have pork and other, or it might have fish in it, but of course we made a vegan version. It's just grated turnips, water, and rice flour, and it thickens, and then you let it solidify, and then you're supposed to fry it or saute it, which I tried a few just because I wanted to see what it was like. It was a disaster. And then Gary had the great idea, bake them. So yeah, we baked them just kind of like the baked potato pancakes, and they're fantastic. So I'll post a recipe soon, but
the
turnip
so good.
Is a new addition to our menu.
Yeah, and it's the same concept as the you chefs out there will probably already be one step or two steps ahead of us. So it's the same concept. You know, you're grating the turnips and you're adding the rice flour to it, and then you're steaming it. You have to steam it first, so you put it in a bain. Again, Karen, the French for bain.
Bain-marie.
Yeah, a water bath. Marie's bath.
Yeah.
After Marie got out of the bath, they cooked in it. I don't know. Don't ask me. That just popped into my head. I don't know why. But anyway, and then you bake it after you slice it. And it was phenomenal. Okay. So why do you want to go plant-based for the holidays? Why do you want to start? Because of kindness and compassion towards all living things, right? I mean, is that too corny to say? No. Cesar Chavez said it best. Here I am, the curator of quotes. I have to go out with a quote. Kindness and compassion towards all living things is a mark of a civilized society. Conversely, cruelty, whether it is directed against human beings or against animals, is not the exclusive province of any one culture or community of people. Thank you, Señor Chavez. Okay.
Thank you, Gary DeMattei. I also wanted to add, we have like a minute left or a minute or two. I'm around a lot of people that I care about, a lot of people that I love, and we all have aging parents, and we see what they are falling to. Could be a heart disease, heart attack, diabetes. My mom has dementia right after Thanksgiving. She had a mini stroke. We were in the hospital for 4 days. And we know that food is a major contributor to chronic disease. And so I ask myself, why wouldn't other people that I know and love that see these things falling to their parents, why wouldn't they be jumping on eating as healthy as they possibly can? I ask you that, my listeners. Why? I mean, that should be the clearest motivation, that you don't want to fall
especially
apart.
when you see that they've taken a CT scan of your mom's arteries and they're filled with plaque. And what's the thing that fills your arteries with plaque, Karen?
Animal food.
Animal foods, right. And so, and that stops the flow to your brain of the blood, and that's what causes the dementia and the strokes and all of that. So if you are a narcissist, the first thing I would think that you'd want to do is go plant-based so that your arteries don't fill up with plaque.
Exactly. Narcissists should go vegan. Anyway, yep. We're out of time once again. And
that's a great way to end it.
I want to end on a delicious note. We have just so many wonderful, delicious recipes for you to eat healthier, be healthier, enjoy yourself. And I hope you check some of them out. And thank you, Gary, for joining me. Everybody have a really delicious week. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Find us at Responsible Eating and Living. And if you have a few more pennies left for Giving Tuesday, you can go over to our website and maybe share a few with us. We'd appreciate that. Again, Bye. Have a delicious week.
Bye, Karen.